from Progressive Voices. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Good afternoon. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector with a little, a little frog in my throat. Here once again on News Dissector Now Media Channel Radio here on PRN.FM. I'm here today with Stu from MediaChannel.org, who's going to be adding to the conversation and participating in it on this radio show. We're part of the Media Channel. We urge you to check it out online, MediaChannel.org. We have two compelling articles of many, but the two latest ones that I wanted to call to your attention deal with a campaign by neoconservatives to actually support an anchor woman leaving RT and trying to discredit the Russia Today network as part of a political, not a media, offensive. And you can read about that as well as the conflicts within Pacifica Radio, an article that really analyzes what's happening in Pacifica, and it's not very good. So check that out. Today on our program, we have two really important and valuable guests. Lewis Lapham, here in New York, he's a reporter, an author, veteran magazine editor, now the founder of his own magazine, the very brilliant Lapham's Quarterly. And Lewis will be here to chat with us about his work and his life. At 5:30, we cross the ocean to England to speak to Dean Starkman, a financial reporter and editor of the Columbia Journalism Review. He's the author of a new book on financial journalism called The Watchdog That Didn't Bark. It's been described as a sweeping, incisive postmortem that discusses the critical shortcomings that softened coverage in the business press during the mortgage era and the years leading up to the financial collapse of 2007-2008. So that's coming up. Let's get started. We have a musical overture, one of our favorite media songs, News Goo.
Wish you were soft and smooth.
The world in a minute.
Morning sound stations carry no news of the world.
Corporate America owns all the networks.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is identification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. ABC, Disney, NBC, GE, Murdoch is Foxy, and with a hint, he owns a pen. The camera, the sword, by a Coke, by a Ford, getting broke, getting bored.
Elvis Presley.
O.J. Simpson, abandoned baby.
Order now.
What we want, what we need, what we want, what we need. But do we even know who plants the seeds? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling proof. Who owns media? Who does it speak for? Your butt's on the sofa, your mind.
Who owns media? Who does it speak for? I think our guest, Lewis Lapham, I might have some answers to that. He's a media legend who describes himself this way in his distinctive history-oriented magazine, Lapham's Quarterly, a publication that's not only provocative and editorially challenging, but stunning in its design and mission. The magazine says of its editor, Lewis Lapham is editor of Lapham's Quarterly, formerly editor of Harper's Magazine. He's the author of numerous books, including Money and Class in America, Theater of War, Gag Rule, and most recently, Pretensions to Empire. The New York Times has likened him to M.L. Mencken. Vanity Fair has suggested a strong resemblance to Mark Twain. And Tom Wolfe has compared him to Montaigne. I hope I said that right. A native of San Francisco, Mr. Lapham was educated at Yale and Cambridge and in the trenches of modern media. Welcome, Lewis, to our program, and pleased that you could join us.
Well, I'm delighted to be here, Danny. I take it as an honor to be asked by you to speak on the subject of the media.
Well, that's very nice of you. Now, you grew up, there are those of us who grew up in rock and roll radio, as I did, used to use the phrase, what a strange trip it's been. Now, tell us about yours. What turned you on to the world of media and letters? For those meeting you for the first time, how and why did you become one of the country's best-known media mavericks?
Well, I started out as a newspaper reporter for the San Francisco Examiner in 1957, and I had gone to Yale 1952-56, and during my summer vacation, I'd worked at a copy boy for the San Francisco Chronicle. These are old-fashioned front page-like broadsheets in 57, and the Examiner was a Hearst paper, And the Monarch of the Dailies, it was the first paper that Hearst had acquired in the late, in the 1890s. Hearst had been thrown out of, I'm talking about William Randolph, had been thrown out of Harvard, and he was in Washington. His father was a senator from California, and his father had won the San Francisco Examiner in a poker game. and young William said to him, "Dad, give me the paper, because I think I know what, I think I can do something with newspapers," said William Randolph. And his father gave him the paper, and from there he became, you know, the great mogul and the father of modern tabloid journalism.
Well, how did you move up the food chain in media so I don't know if it was quickly, but over the years, to become an editor and a world famous editor? How did that happen for you?
Well, it happened by accident. I mean, I started at the San Francisco Examiner, where they had, you know, you could smoke, the presses were in the building, copy paper, typewriters. I mean, it was like front page. I stayed there for a little less than 3 years, and I went to the New York and got a job on the New York Herald Tribune, which was a magnificent paper in 1960. Walter Lippmann, Joseph Alsop, Marguerite Higgins, and I was a cityside reporter, and also I was assigned to the UN. I was at the UN when Khrushchev banged his shoe on the table, and in 61 or 62. I also was then sent down to write the color side story for the first shot into space off Cape Canaveral. But after 2 years, 3 years at the Tribune, I became restless and wanted to write at longer lengths. So I got a job as a contract writer for Saturday Evening Post, and that was a wonderful job. I had that. I wrote 8 pieces a year, traveled all over the world, and had a magnificent editor, a man named Otto Friedrich, who taught me everything I know about magazine writing and magazine editing. The Post folded at the end of the 60s, and then I had the same sort of job at Life magazine as a writer. And then Life folded, because what happened, of course, in the 60s is the television takes over the world. In 1960, the two major means of mass communication were the Saturday Post and Life. And by the end of the decade, they were out of business, and what you had were the television networks.
Stu, jump in if you'd like.
Well, I'm interested to know, fast forward a little bit, how you approached your job as an editor. How did you see your obligation and your mission to your readers, and how did that affect what you did in terms of story selection and how you went about running the magazine?
Okay, well, I became the editor of Harper's Magazine by mistake in 1971. The then editor was a man named Willie Morris, who got himself into an argument with the owner, which was the Minneapolis Star and Tribune in Minneapolis, and there was a sharp difference of opinion. Willie resigned, and so did most everybody else on the staff. I had only been in the office twice to deliver manuscripts. So on Tuesday, I was a contributing writer. On Wednesday, I was the pro tem managing editor. So I learned it on. I was the managing editor for 4 years and became editor in 76, January 76. And it was on the job learning. What I was trying to get to was I was trying to publish pieces on both sides of the aisle. In other words, I could have, in one issue, I can remember having an essay by Michael Harrington, who was firmly of the left in the early 70s, and in the same issue I have an essay by Irving Kristol coming at it with a conservative criticism of the liberal regime that had been in place since the New Deal. So I tried to have argument in terms of the political coverage essay, and then with the reporting I wanted the long narrative. I have great faith in first person singular. So, and the New Yorker in those days always had the same tone of voice. I mean, they kind of had it in the, I don't know, it was in the third person, and there was something that was the same tone all the way through the magazine, just the way it was the same tone all the way through Time magazine and the Atlantic Monthlies also. And so what I wanted to do was to give the writers their heads. In other words, by that time I was writing a column of my own for the magazine every month, and I didn't need to try to express my thoughts through a writer. In other words, I wanted the writer to get as close to his own voice, her own voice, as possible. There were a lot of young and good writers around then, as there are now. And to me, the most fun was to say to a young writer, you know, here we're going to publish your very first, this is going to be your first published piece. That kind of discovery was always an excitement to me. So I published some of the, you know, finest essayists and reporters going at the time.
Well, just to add one note to all of this, Lewis, I was a good friend with Andy Copkind, who was, you know, like maybe one of the best writers at Time Magazine. Yeah. He did a lot of the cover stories. Yeah. And he wrote a piece about it in the New York Review of Books, and he said, you know, I used to work for Time, or was it Cell? Because his copy was seen by the editors of Time as a file, which they would then process into whatever kind of corporate journalism that they were practicing. And so Andy's unique voice would get buried in his own pieces sometimes. And he was unhappy with that and finally left. But this is a tension, isn't it, in journalism to let, you know, many flowers bloom.
Yes, and of course that gets started. That sort of an idea comes out of what was called the New Journalism, which was the '60s, which was Tom Wolfe and Joan Didion and Gay Talese and David Halberstam and a number of other people who you know. But that idea of a first person singular begins to overtake the formal idea of rigorous objectivity, just the facts, ma'am, you know, that approach. So that was changing, started to change in the '60s. And then in the '80s, I mean, and there's that, a lot of that kind of writing in the '70s. I mean, and then in the '80s, it begins to split into political polemic. Once the FCC, I think it's 1983 or 1984, allows radio and news stations to rant in the manner of Limbaugh, and in the Reagan administration, it begins to divide. So you have very sharply ideological difference on the left and the right. You have, on the one side of the aisle, you have the Nation, on the other side, you have the National Review, and they don't meet.
You know,
they begin talking to themselves. It's like what you have now with Rachel Maddow at MSNBC and O'Reilly at Fox. I mean, it's no fun to listen to for me, because it's I know what they're going to say.
It becomes predictable. Stu,
yeah.
To your point, which was how an editor thinks about this, I mean, you also had an owner that you had to deal with, and you also had a marketplace that you had to deal with as an editor. You weren't totally free to do your own thing.
No, that's not quite true. I was, because the Minneapolis Tribune shut it down, and they folded the Harper's Magazine in 1980, I think, and because it was, by that time, it was losing $2 or $3 million a year. And he had always lost money, and they were willing to pay the price. And it had been up until, it's the oldest magazine in America, published, it began in 1850, and it was an outgrowth of the Harper Brothers publishing, book publishing company. And they used it as a lost leader. They used it as a way to find new writers and to advertise in serial form their forthcoming books. And it really never made money. I mean, it was supported by the publishing house. And then when the Coles family, Minneapolis, took it over in the 50s, the bills were being paid by the success of the Minneapolis Star and Tribune Company, which also at that time had acquired the major interest in the book publisher Harper & Row. So it was never a money-making thing. And the but the losses got to be too heavy for Coles in 1980. They announced the folding of the magazine. We did not miss an issue, and then it was acquired by the MacArthur Foundation in Chicago, the big, John R. Catherine T. MacArthur. And that is still in the person, the current publisher of Harper's Magazine, John R. MacArthur, is the grandson of the tycoon. And so Harper's was set up as a foundation in 1984 when I redesigned it, and it's backed by John MacArthur and by, to some extent, he now has his own foundation, and that's the, so it's not that that was the model. And I therefore had the freedom to make the best magazine that I could.
Well, you were always very good, I thought, at finding very imaginative, even catchy ways of packaging information,
yeah,
making you want to read them, like the Harper's
yeah.
Index
yeah.
that became a breakthrough feature. What was the idea behind that? What kind of feedback did you get?
Well, at the first, I did two things. It was not only the index. I did this in 1984. And I said that I had been fired in 1981 and then rehired in 1983, and I agreed to be rehired on condition that I could completely redesign the magazine, and that included the index. It also included the readings, which is another feature of the magazine, which are essentially like blog posts, although aggregated from journals all over the world. And the at first I was vilified by the New York media, the custodians of the culture, and how could I reduce something to such short form? But I also had long form. I mean, I had the short index in one way, the readings in another. I mean, the readings came from poetry journals, they came from academic journals, they came from scientific journals, literary journals all over the world, and run to the length of anywhere between 500 and 1200 words. But then I also had in each issue a long essay and a long report, but only one of each. I mean, because those things are hard, it's hard to find. Good writing doesn't grow on trees, and in the old form, in the Harper's form, in the 60s and 70s, there used to be 7 or 8 long articles in each issue, and to find 7 or 8 long articles in all of the magazines over the course of 6 months is hard enough, but to try to do it every month it's not easy. But if you only have to do one long report and one long essay and then maybe one long literary review, as well as the shorter pieces, it becomes more workable.
Stu, you were raising with him this whole issue of how a editor functions, but it seems like it also, you need to have editorial freedom to do what you were doing. Stu, do you want to add to that, Stu?
Yeah, no, it seems like you were in a very fortunate position that you really, that you didn't have to deal with any constraints stemming from catering to advertisers. But I'm interested in the approach of really providing, well, multiple sides of the political spectrum, or both sides of the political spectrum, should I say, and having an evolving conversation rather than the fair, once the fairness doctrine goes bye-bye, you really have a stratification of and really a catering to a confirmation bias. Did you, once that happened, did you see any changes borne out in your circulation and the desire of your readers' feedback from them, or did you just keep it going and you found that there still was a market for that regardless of whatever changes?
Well, I made more of the narrative pieces than I did of the political essay. In other words, the I put more emphasis on sending people, you know, to wherever, Iraq, down the Congo River, into the Gulf Stream. I mean, long, you know, reporting pieces, and the I began to go more in that direction, and the I have the occasional political essay, but I always tried to have the writer who was writing the political essay put some historical context into it, right? Explain, and if it was in the first person, explain where he or she was coming from, and try to have it in a more of a conversational tone of voice. An historian's tone of voice rather than in a activist tone of voice. In other words, I was more interested in how does Washington work, let's say, than castigating scoundrels. I assumed all present were scoundrels. I mean, I took that for granted, right?
But this historical interest of yours, orientation of yours, passion of yours, didn't stop when you retired from Harper's. You actually started your own quarterly with serious and diverse takes on subjects of all kinds. Money was one issue I read. Revolution is the current issue this spring. What is in this format that you couldn't do before? You know, it's a pricey magazine, too, so you're writing maybe for an upscale audience. I don't know.
Well, I am, but it's also, I should tell you, the fastest growing magazine in America as we speak. I mean, we now have, a year ago we had a circulation of 28,000 and it's now 38,000. And,
wow.
And to grow by that kind of, on that steep a curve, I mean, the numbers of course aren't as big as many other magazines, but the movement upward on the graph, for the circulation is very heartening, and it sells for a fairly high number. It sells for $16 on the newsstand but again, the model, I set it up as a foundation, and because I knew that when I was to try to raise money for a print magazine in 2006, which is when I left Harper's to do this, was not an easy. I mean, everybody was talking about the flight into cyberspace and the internet and so on, and also the money, if you remember, was beginning to get very tight in 2006, 2007. So I set it up as a foundation.
Now, but, you know, you've also been consumed by the class dynamics in our culture.
Yeah.
You know, when I grew up, there was a comic strip in the New York Post called Mary Worth, one panel of which ridiculed the idea, with one of the characters saying, "The only classes in our country are in schools." Okay, was how they put it. How important to you, maybe to your life and to your work, is an understanding of class and getting people to see the world in class terms?
Well, I mean, Americans have been very reluctant to see it. You know, the egalitarian mythos is very much ingrained into the American scheme of things. But the truth, of course, is that there's no society in history that's ever not been arranged in terms of some sort of a class hierarchy. I mean, that was the that was the intention of the people who wrote the Constitution in Philadelphia in 1787. I mean, the government ought to be maintained, says James Madison, by the people with the wisdom to perceive and the virtue to pursue the public good. And that meant people of property. And the of the first 10 presidents in the United of the United States, 8 would have had a net worth in today's money of $1 billion. And that's money in rents, slaves, and various capital ventures.
But you grew up as a wealthy family, or
yeah, I did.
You know, so you know, are you considered a class enemy?
Well, yes, I have been. I mean, yes, I mean that's true. I've been attacked as a class enemy, but I also got attacked once for being. I got up in a discussion at the Naval War College in I think 1971. It was a panel discussion about the press and the military. If you remember, there was some disagreement during the Vietnam War between the military on one side and the
okay.
So this was a conference to address that question on the stage in front of the Naval War College, and I was even handed about it, Danny. I mean, I made points about where the media's virtues were and also where it was less than perfect, and I said the same thing about the media, the press. I mean, the press is a running dog. I mean, the idea that the press is the truth, as you and I both know, is an illusion. I mean, the Truman put it very clearly. He once said that, and I quote, "I pity anybody who thinks they have any idea of what was going on in the world by reading the newspapers." And the I mean, this was understood when I was a part of the as a newspaper reporter. I mean, we knew what the limits of the business were in the 50s and the even in the early 60s. But the press begins, you know, as the century goes on, the press begins to give itself airs and pretensions to grandeur that are undeserved.
Can you read newspapers today or watch TV news without retching? I mean, can you see it as part of a information culture, or is it part of something else?
Well, it's probably something else. I mean, the mainstream press thinks of itself as a function of government. I mean, you remember the appalling goodbye to Tim Russert. I mean, Tim Russert, when he died suddenly of a heart attack a few years ago. I mean, it was a 3-day special on all the networks, the greatest journalist of our time, and so on. And that's just utter nonsense. I mean, I'm sure Russert was a very nice person. I didn't know him, but I mean, but as a television person, he was nothing but a mouthpiece for government, and that was his function, just the way it was the function of when Dan Rather was swanning around as the hard-hitting White House.
Only you would say swanning around. Last point, Stu.
Well, I'm interested to know how Lewis thinks class would weigh on the future of journalism, considering
I'll tell you exactly.
Well, I mean, people of lesser means are coming out of school with massive debt loads, walking into unpaid internships, and then there's the whole dynamic of right for us for free for exposure. What's your advice to younger people that are thinking about getting in journalism? Run for your life and check into a mental ward, or is there some light at the end of the tunnel?
Well, yeah, there's light at the end of the tunnel because there's always going to be a small marginal free press. I mean the opposition press in this country. There's never been much of an opposition press, starting in, you know, going back to 1790. But the difference is that when I came out of college and when I went into the newspaper business, I never expected to make any money out of it. That's not the reason one became a journalist. I mean, that was not the reason that one tried to become a writer. I can remember coming to New York in 1960 and going to a cocktail party in the Upper East Side, and a pretty girl in a lovely dress asked me what I did for a living, and I said I was a newspaper man. I was very proud of it. I had a very romantic idea of it, and she looked at me and with a sort of faint amusement and said, "What are you going to do when you grow up?"
I can't think of a better point on which to leave this right now. Lewis, thank you so much for joining us. Lewis Lapham, joining us on Media Channel Radio with Stu. Coming up, we're going to go over to England and talk about financial reporting with Dean Starkman, one of the deans of financial reporting and editor of the Columbia Journalism Review. So please stay with us.
To chase and to Wachovia. Wells Fargo, Sally Mae, to MasterCard and Citibank, and also B of A. American Express and Visa Morgan Stanley, too. In debt we trust.
Well, thank you. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector, editor of MediaChannel.org, here on Media Channel Radio with my colleague Stu here in New York City. We are trying to get through to our guest in England, Dean Starkman, managing editor of the Columbia Journalism Review. We have a number for him and are trying to reach him. So please give us your best patient wishes so that we can make this happen. Stu, thoughts about Lewis Lapham, who we heard from before?
Well, I've loved Lewis's writing for God knows how long at this point. And additionally, I loved the docu. Well, I don't know. So you're going to call it a documentary, but his film, "The American Ruling Class." And what stays with me is a line, and he's obviously talking about the ruling class. But the line is, "No use for the news that the world is not oneself." And if we had Lewis with us for longer, I wanted to ask him, that does that actually apply just to a ruling class, that knowledge of what they do in the world and the negative ramifications for others is easily overlooked? Or is it broadened out now to even lower classes, just in the context that people can't really afford to have the news interfere with what they need to do on a daily basis, have the attention, the time to drill into something? They're just focused on their three jobs, their nine to midnight shifts, and what the ramifications are of that for our society.
Well, you know, having worked in mainstream or lamestream media for many years, you would always find editors in a way denying and scoffing at the idea of class. You know, somehow that was appropriate in other countries or in other times, but not in modern America. The idea of class analysis was perceived as some sort of crude formulation, vaguely Marxist, and completely irrelevant to what was going on. And yet, that's what they would say editorially. In their business affairs and in their sales departments, they were extremely class conscious. They were very demographic oriented to try to find, you know, the right audiences who will buy, you know, the products that their advertisers are selling, and to have programs that, you know, are in sync with those demographic aspirations. So class became a way of actually finding and divining the audience, whereas, you know, they were very class conscious when it came to business, not so much when it came to reporting. You know, this is a constant problem. You know, some years ago, I worked on a video for a documentary on the working class majority. And this was a study, a study that Michael Zweig has done, a professor out at Stony Brook, talking about how class is extremely relevant to America, and that if you look at it closely, the majority of Americans are in the working class, broadly defined. But, you know, we couldn't find anyone interested in funding or running that kind of film. Does that surprise you, Stu?
Oh, not in the least. I mean, I would attribute a great deal of the reluctance to openly discuss it to the Cold War and associations with Marx, communism, etc. And, yeah, so that doesn't surprise me in the least. And I open up my browser today. Here's another thing. We've talked about it. It drives me nuts. It's really a chicken and egg dynamic that I can't wrap my head around to really form a conclusion on. I open up my browser. I go to Yahoo, my homepage. What do I see? I see Julia Rancich, oh, her worst interview. I see, oh, couple dies within minutes of one another. There was something else. I forget what it was. It was something about the plane in Malaysia, I think. And then it was finally the fifth story in the rotation there was about sanctions for Russia over Crimea. And I can't help but wonder, are those stories, the ones that are not the important story or have any real world implications, is that something that is demanded by the audience, and is Yahoo in this instance feeding that demand, or is it something that's creating a demand? And it, I mean, ultimately it comes down to ease. I get off my job. Who the hell wants to deal with Crimea? What the hell does that have to do with me? I'm back on the clock in another 15 minutes. I want to say hello to my kids for one hot minute. But I'm just, historically, I can't help but wonder, has there always been a market for this, or is this just something that's come into the frame over the past, 20 years or so, and is really dumbing down our population and putting out this red meat that serves only to really distract people?
A good question. We'll have to hold any answers or more discussion of it for a while, because thanks to the wonders of technology at the Progressive Radio Network, we now have Dean Starkman on the phone from England. So our next guest, Dean Starkman, is a managing editor of the Columbia Journalism Review's The Audit, an online project on financial journalism. He's a reporter for two decades. He was most recently a Katrina Media Fellow with the Open Society Institute. He covered the insurance industry's response to Hurricane Katrina. He spent a year covering white-collar crime for The Washington Post. He spent 8 years as a Wall Street Journal staff writer, 4 as a national real estate writer, 2 years as a white-collar crime specialist. He's a former chief of the Providence Journal's investigative unit. He won numerous national and regional awards and helped lead the team that won the 1994 Pulitzer Prize for Investigations. He's a graduate of McGill University and Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. Most importantly, he's the author of a new book, The Watchdog That Didn't Bark. So why don't we start with that, Dean? Thanks for being with us and your patience.
Thank you, Danny. It's entirely my pleasure.
What is The Watchdog That Didn't Bark? What watchdog is that? And bark about what?
Sure. The book's called The Watchdog That Didn't Bark, The Financial Crisis and the Disappearance of Investigative Journalism. The watchdog was the mainstream business press, and the thing it was supposed to be barking at was the practices of Wall Street banks and major mortgage lenders in the years leading up to the financial crisis. That was a substantial journalism failure, and it was one of the key reasons why the public and the press itself was so caught off guard by the crisis of 2008.
I mean, everything was going so well, I was told, at the time.
Right. Yeah, I mean, to do this, this book stemmed from a project that we did it for the Columbia Journalism Review in 2009, and it was essentially a kind of a grand content analysis of major business news from the years 2000 to mid-2007. And we looked over 9 major business publications, all the ones you're familiar with, Wall Street Journal, Forbes, Fortune, etc. And what we were looking for really was just reporting that would purported or tried to hold to account the major financial institutions that essentially caused the crisis, and there was such a scarcity of this kind of reporting that I'm arguing was the real reason why the public was so caught off guard at the time.
You know, you write, as the mortgage era dawned, deep cultural and structural shifts, some unavoidable, some self-inflicted, eroded journalism's appetite for its role as watchdog. The result was a deafening silence about the systemic corruption in the financial industry, which leads to questions like this. What was self-inflicted? What was avoidable? And was there really any appetite to play a watchdog role in the first place?
Well, Danny, that's a fair question. I mean, the reason I called the book's called The Watchdog That Didn't Bark, and the title, of course, presupposes there is such a thing as a watchdog. The book has ten chapters, but a lot, you know, the first third of the book is devoted to trying to demonstrate that, in fact, mainstream business press and the media in general, you know, over the decades has assumed a fairly formidable watchdog role, and that's to me, that's the greater tragedy, that there was this retreat during the moment when it was needed most. You ask, like, what were the things that were external? What were the things that were self-inflicted? I see three pieces to that puzzle. And the first was not journalism's fault. One was this, you know, this radical deregulation that was ushered in by the Bush administration, which really weakens investigative reporting, because there's a real correlation and synthesis between uncompromised regulation and forthright journalism. The second piece of the puzzle was this business crisis that journalism itself was undergoing during the years leading up to the mortgage crisis, when there was a giant ad recession in the beginning of the decade, and then the internet began to seriously erode business news's both financial models and I would argue their confidence. But the last piece really was self-inflicted, and these were this is sort of these deep-rooted cultural problems within the business press itself and within the mainstream media, where we had, you know, and I say that because I was a practitioner for so long, where we had developed this, what I think is very formidable tradition of investigative and accountability reporting. And it was really, went into eclipse during this period because of the two factors that I mentioned, but also these were really editorial decisions made by news managers and news ownership.
Stu, you know a lot about the business world, the financial world as well. What's your take on it, as somebody who's been following this very closely?
You know, you're asking.
No, I'm asking my colleague who's here with us, who you haven't met yet, who to chime in on this.
Yeah, sure.
Confusion. I'd like to know how the financial press can serve as a watchdog when you're dealing with an environment of banks, bank executives that have an interest in being opaque. You have regulators that are biding their time to slide through the revolving door. You have analysts and rating agencies that are directly tied to the profits and maintaining the relationship with the companies they arguably cover and certify, and should I say debt issues they certify. And you have politicians that are wedded to that cash machine as well. What's the press to do in that environment as far as fleshing out what's really going on?
That's a fair question, but I would turn it around. All those circumstances actually increase the obligation of the press, right? They purport to be the independent, external eye on the system, not part of the system, right? I mean, that's what the claim is, and I try to demonstrate in the book that over the years they have actually demonstrated that to be the case. So when regulation is in retreat, when the political system is subsumed by private interests, when really the public, when the public interest is really under its most threat, I mean, that's when journalism is most needed. And what I'd say about this is, you say, well, you know, really, what can the press do? And you know what I found when I looked through the data, basically the content that was produced, I found, despite the fact that, you know, large news organizations, you know, weren't really in the game on this, there were reporters out there, most of them not in the mainstream press, many of them working for alternative media, who were exactly on the story. You know, they were doing the stories about Citigroup and about AmeriQuest and about Lehman Brothers' connection to subprime and all of that. Unfortunately, they just didn't happen to work for the mainstream business press, the large news organizations. And this kind of stuff, in fact, had been done before this era. It will be done again in some other era, I'm sure. But what I'm saying is that if somebody from the Pittsburgh City Paper, a guy named Richard Lord, in fact, to be specific, could really blow the whistle on predatory lending in the inner cities and its connection to Wall Street during the years 2003-2004, there's no real reason why conventional reporting couldn't do the same thing.
Was it something to do with kind of a cultural wannabes? In other words, a lot of people who were in journalists who wanted to report on financial issues were encouraged to get MBAs, go to schools that specialized in all this, and they become sort of, they culturally begin to identify with the people that they're covering. Some of them want to be the people that they're covering. So it's hard to be adversarial when you have the same values and the worldview of the people that you cover. It's hard to imagine that these people are bad guys when you see, at least or hear, that they're really good people, or you've met them and you feel that way about them. Is that cultural factor a factor?
It's huge, Danny. But one thing I think we should recognize is that, of course, that's quite right. But one thing I think we should recognize is that, of course, journalism isn't one thing. It's a field, and within the field, there are competing tendencies. In my book, I try to lay a theoretical framework for this argument, and the way I divide basically the journalism world is into two different approaches. One is access reporting, and one is accountability reporting. Now, these are both valuable in their own way, but the kind of approach that you describe, of course, falls into the former camp. Within those two, these are competitions and tensions within newsrooms that have really been going on for 100 years, and usually it's a healthy tension. However, you know, the accountability, you know, approach has always been the most, you know, the minority report within newsrooms. It's always under pressure. It's always beleaguered, and it has had periods of ebbs and flows. And you know, the kind of reporting that you describe, you know, was really, you know, as you suggest, in ascendance during this period. This is sort of the merger and acquisition deal reporters, the guys who are trying to get the scoops from the big shots. Again, that's all fine, but there has to be space for the other kind of reporting, is the Gretchen Morgenson type reporting, and an army like her that would also have a different mission, which is to hold these institutions to account. You definitely have the kind you describe, but you also need the other.
Well, just last week, I think, or 2 weeks ago, recently, okay, there was a big story that was not really broken by the press, but by the audit department of the Department of Justice that basically looked into the government claiming that it wanted to prosecute the mortgage fraudsters, but then quietly made prosecuting them their lowest priority. And the Justice Department reported on this, but I don't think the media really reported on it. Even the Madoff Ponzi scheme was not made public by the press, but by a conflict within his own family. So, you know, how reliable, how trustworthy is the business media in terms as a guide to what's going on in business?
Look, they're not going to, you know, they're not going to get every story. But, yeah, I mean, you do expect them to you know, to do their part, right? I mean, there's going to be, you know, obviously you're happy about revelations by inspectors general or state attorneys general or state banking commissioners or you know, the entire regulatory system when it's operating in an uncompromised fashion. And those actually can help journalism to a great degree. And journalism, when it's working right, can also help regulators. And there can be a real positive dynamic in that regard. I mean, right, but I understand how frustrating that can be. That OIG report from the Department of Justice, I mean, really, it did reveal things that the press probably couldn't have gotten at, but really that was also a matter, I think, as you're suggesting, that the press should have been curious about. I mean, here we had this cataclysmic disaster.
Yeah, I read one report.
That was sort of awash in fraud, at least, that's what, by all appearances. And you wonder, like, where, you know, what became of white-collar prosecution.
Well,
was a question for the press.
You're in England now, and the bank.
I'm in Budapest, but
okay.
Same difference.
I thought you were in England. Anyway, the Bank of England has been making some really radical statements recently about economics and about fraud as being part of the system, and that none of this is aberrant, that it's really part of the whole way things have worked. They seem to be very outspoken.
Right.
About these issues, and it's something that, you know, really is seen or is very visible, you know, in our press. You know, somehow the person who's the critic, you know, is considered sort of irresponsible for making allegations,
right,
which now the people at the very heart of the system are making.
Well, that's sort of the tragedy that your other guest was kind of alluding to. For whatever reason, sure, the press takes its cues from people in power. And really, you really needn't do that. No one says it has to. But of course, right in the UK, the Bank of England has, and some of its regulators have been much more robust in their response to the, you know, this spree of wrongdoing that took place, has been taking place in the banking sector for a while. In our case, you know, we have, you know, a singularly quiescent team, cadre of financial regulation that really has done, you know, the public, I think, a real disservice in failing to step up and really address the huge problems that have been caused. You know, I grew up in a, I came of sort of age in the 80s and 90s as a reporter when white-collar prosecution was quite robust. I mean, Robert Morgenthau and Rudy Giuliani and Elliot Spitzer and, you know, all these people were, you know, at the latter end were actually quite feared on Wall Street. Gary Lynch was a very famous enforcement chief for the Securities and Exchange Commission in the 80s. You know, these were formidable figures and, you know, and rightly feared on Wall Street. And, you know, they've gone into eclipse. And, you know, I would argue, you know, that's not really an excuse for the press to do the same thing. In fact, it's a reason to do the opposite.
Well, you know, Dean, we're running out of time. I wanted Stu to come in. Tell us, where do you get your business news, and who do you read, for accurate information?
Well, that's a good.
Let's just ask Stu that for a moment. I'm sorry, he's not here, so he's on another phone. And
no worries.
More often than not, I find myself reading the muckrakers on the margins. Well, arguably on the margins, the Matt Taibbis, the Mike Whitneys, the Mike Hudsons. Well, what I was getting at with my previous question is what you termed the access avenues are compromised. Really, I think the resort of the financial press has to be to go on the ground locally and
see. Of course, absolutely.
Or how they're being borne out in the lives of the people that are out here, that are using these products and to a large degree being victimized by them. But that said, the large consolidated media institutions do have an economic self-interest. Many of them are exchange-listed, and you get a dynamic where you get a rising tide lifting the all equities in the market. Right. And it seems like they have a vested interest of being unconcerned because they themselves are making money when these bubbles inflate, and they only really
I'm sorry, but we're going to have to end it here because we're running out of time, but we've ran out of time. Thank you, Dean Starkman, in Budapest, for being with us. Me too. If we didn't have those problems, maybe you can come back and join us again because we're going to be doing this for a while. Check out mediachannel.org. You can write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org. We will feature these interviews on mediachannel.org as we have earlier interviews that are up there now with the Ray McGovern and the interviews about Venezuela and earlier interviews that we've done, one with Richard Wolff, who's, of course, an economist, talking about economics in the media. Stay with us. I'm Danny Schechter, your News Dissector. Thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week.
Good night, guys.
I heard the auction hammer knocking down his home. But the banks are made of marble with a guard.